Feels good. Feels good.
The time has come to enjoy myself. Hello, greetings and hi there. This is the Head Speaks Podcast, a proud member of the Head Cast family. I am your host, Aaron Moss, also known as Brother Head. Welcome to Head Speaks, where I'll be talking about comics, movies, and recent news items that interest me. Basically anything that strikes my fancy.
Warning! Warning!
This podcast may not be family friendly. Head Speaks may contain adult language, adult content, fantasy violence, and nudity. You have been warned. The young, stupid, and easily offended may not want to listen to this headcast. In other words, parental guidance is more than suggested. Now, before we get started today, let's hear a word from a friend of the show.
Kalibak, Tassad, it is I, Darkseid. I command you to listen to the Who's Who podcast. Uncover the powers and weaknesses of the Super Friends so that I may destroy them.
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC Who's Who. Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisia and Woozy Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC Who's Who.
Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe.
Available monthly at Aquaman Shrine, Firestorm Fan, and on iTunes and Stitcher as part of the Fire and Water Podcast.
Movies with Head. This episode we're going to do something a little different. Instead of me sitting here talking about a movie or TV show that I really like, this week I'm going to pimp someone else's podcast. Who's, you may ask? My buddy Gene Hendricks has a podcast called The Hammer Strikes, The Legends of the Superheroes podcast. You may have heard me advertise it. If you listen closely after this segment, you're going to hear it again. He's recently had me on where we discuss 1994's The Crow. Watch for it to be released soon from Hammer Strikes, Legends of the Superheroes podcast. The Crow starred Brandon Lee, which was Bruce Lee's son, where he unfortunately died while filming the movie. Me and Gene get into that a little bit. I don't want to go too much into this right now because, again, me and Gene are going to be talking about it on his upcoming Legends of Superheroes podcast. Just say I really enjoyed the first one. The sequels, from what I've heard, weren't so good. And the TV series they had, again, I heard from a friend that wasn't so great, but I never did see it. So we'll sit back and listen, and here's a little excerpt from the upcoming
The Legends of the Superheroes
podcast. Or me and Gene talk about 1994's The Crow.
And I noticed how Eric kept marking everything, you know, all the times that he actually killed somebody. He marked it with an outline of a crow. And at the one point where he kills T-Bird, he does it, but it's in lighter fluid, so it's a big flaming crow. And my note says, well, now we know where the flaming DD came from in Daredevil.
Well, it's funny, as my 21-year-old son was sitting here watching part of it with me, and when that scene came on, he looked at me, he's like, hey, Daredevil! So, yeah, I don't know if they took it from this or if this came from somewhere else, but yes, you can very much see, because, I mean, this wasn't a small movie. Everyone heard of it, especially with Brandon's passing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm sure that they got some inspiration for that Daredevil scene from this element to the story also.
Yeah, and you can tell, even though he's this tortured soul, come back for revenge, he's still a smart aleck.
Oh, yeah, very.
Because in the apartment, Ernie said, oh, are you going to disappear into the thin air? Goes, no, I was going to use your front door.
Yeah, no, I very much enjoyed Eric's personality, his witty sarcasm, if you will. I really like that. Another thing, when back before Eric killed Tintin, when he was jumping around the roofs, my wife's like, hey, it's parkour before it's parkour.
Yeah, really?
So I'm like, I'm not sure when exactly. I tried looking on Wikipedia, but I couldn't find a definite answer when it became in popularity with a quick search. But yes, it was very parkour of Brandon. I'm sure he did all that himself.
Oh, yeah.
With his father being who his father is.
Well, from what I read, basically the entire movie was done except for like three scenes when he was killed. So
yeah, that's what I heard.
So it's, you know, only a couple of things that he was not actually involved in. And for those of you out there that are thinking, like, I'm pretty sure a lot of people did, oh, I'm going to watch the movie sequence and find the scene where he gets killed, it ain't in there. The film, they were filming when he was killed, when he was shot with this gun. But that was only developed to be used in the investigation, and then it was destroyed. So it is actually not part of this movie.
Okay, yeah, see, because I'd read on, I think it was Wikipedia, that it said that, I think it was the scene where they shoot Eric at the beginning was the scene where he died.
Yes.
So I wasn't sure if yeah, and I'm sure they wouldn't actually use that footage.
Yeah, they had to reshoot that with a double.
And there you have a couple of excerpts from mine and Gene's little talk about The Crow. You want to hear more? Well, look on your iTunes, your Zune player, your Stitcher Radio, whatever you listen to this podcast on, and keep an eye out for Gene Hendricks, The Hammer Strikes, The Legends of the Superheroes podcast, and an upcoming one, me and him will talk about The Crow. And again, I am pimping this right now because I am going to be on it soon, but I would pimp it anyways because I really enjoy Gene's shows. I think he's got a great voice for radio. And as he has said, he's got the face for radio too. Another feeling. Anyways, but no, he's got a great show. Check it out if you get a chance. But that's going to be it for this episode of At the Movies with Head. Here you go. Go ahead and listen to another advertisement. Guess who it's from? Hold on.
Hi, I'm Gene Hendricks. You may remember me from such shows as The Hammer Podcasts and The Quantum Cast. I'd like to tell you about some special shows that I'm doing with some of your favorite podcasters. These shows are all about the live-action versions of comic book characters, and I'm calling them
Legends of the Superheroes!
In each episode, we'll be looking at a different TV show or movie featuring characters like
Dr. David Banner.
And let's not forget about the non-superheroes, such as
Swamp Thing,
Captain William Buck Rogers,
and many more. Look for the Legends of the Superheroes specials under the Hammer Podcasts at twotruefreaks.com.
And now it's time to move on to
than a speeding bullet.
In the Great Hall of the Justice League,
Spider-Man and his amazing friends.
The Justice League of America versus the Legion of Doom. This is
What's in Head's Long Box.
Dedicated to truth, justice, and peace for all mankind. The world's greatest super friends.
This episode, I'm going to talk about Vertigo's Preacher. I'm going to talk about the first issue, which is a little background. Preacher is a series that consisted of 75 issues in total, There was a 66 regular monthly issues, 5 one-shot specials, and a 4-issue Preacher Santa Killers limited series. The entire run has been collected in 9 trade paperback editions. The final monthly issue, number 66, was published in October of 2000. The characters in the comic is, the main characters anyways, is Jesse Custer, a.k.a. Preacher, Tulip O'Hare, Cassidy, the Santa Killers, Hair Star, it's H-E-R-R, not Hair, but Air Star, Hair Star, God, and beloved Arseface. We'll hear a little more about them a little bit later on. We'll hear about Arseface in this episode, but let's move on. So anyways, let's go ahead and just cover the first issue, and then we'll go in more detail. The first issue was entitled The Time of the Preacher, written by the brilliance of Garth Ennis, art by Steve Dillon, letter Clam Robbins, colorist is Matt Hollingsworth. It was reprinted in several times. It was reprinted in a trade paperback called Preacher Gone to Texas in 1996, the Millennium Edition Preacher No. 1 in 2000, Vertigo First Offenses trade paperback 2005, Preacher Special Edition No. 1 in 2009, Preacher Volume 1 Hardcover 2009, Preacher Volume 1 trade paperback 2013. So those are all the times it's been reprinted. This bad boy had a cover date of April of 1995, but again, if you wanted to buy it fresh off the newsstand when I bought it, you would have had it been around February the 28th of 1995. That's when I bought it, or thereabouts. That was back when I was going to the comic shop pretty much on a weekly basis. So about around February 28th, maybe the beginning of March. Anyways, the cover price was $2.95. Back then, that was a little bit expensive, but it was a great comic, so it was worth it. Editor was Stuart Moore, and the cover credits was artist Glenn Fabre. Let's go ahead and go into it's not too brief, a synopsis of the story. Jesse Custer, our hero, is sitting around a diner talking with a man in sunglasses and a woman about finding God. Starts out sounding real spiritual. As Jesse tells the story of how this little group met, we go to some flashbacks, and we see Reverend Jesse Custer in a bar. Reverend Custer is a little drunk, and being tired of all their bullshit, he starts telling all the town's secrets. A few of the townies don't care for that, so they beat the snot out of him. We then find out about Genesis. Genesis is a hybrid creature being locked up in heaven, being guarded by some angels. Genesis apparently escaped confinement and is headed to Earth to bond with a soul. The angels say they need someone to go get it. They refer to someone called the Saint of Killers. And they briefly mention here, but we find out later on in the series, that the Genesis was when an angel and a demon fell in love. They mated and they had a child. And Genesis was their child. It was a hybrid creature of both angel and demon that was so powerful they had to keep it locked up. Back to our story, we then hear what was happening about this time with the woman, who we find out name is Tulip. Tulip was attempting to kill somebody, and she failed at it. While she was escaping, she met the Irish man known as Cassidy, the third in our little trio. And while they were escaping, Cassidy was shot in the head, but he paid no mind as he drove off. He just kind of shrugged it off and kept driving. We then get to the other player in our story. One of the angels from earlier goes to a cemetery, and he releases a cowboy that sits up and shoots him in the head. And the angel's laying there. He tells him that he needs to go find Genesis by whatever means necessary. We're back at the church Sunday morning. Reverend Custer's ready to give a sermon to a full church, which he notes is rare for him. Suddenly, a glowing ball bursts through the church, hits Jesse, unleashes a blast of energy that kills everyone present and makes the church explode real good. Short time later, Tulip arrives in Cassidy's truck. We find Cassidy's hidden in the back of the truck and the bed covered with a tarp. And she finds that Jesse's the only living being in the ruins of the church. She drags him out of there, pets him in the truck, takes him to a hospital. After they take off, we meet Sheriff Root, who arrives on the scene and starts investigating the explosion. As he talks, we find out that he's a real redneck, real racist, and he thinks either the damn niggers or aliens was up to no good. Then we then find out from Jesse, who says he has a bunch of memories in his head, that what I mentioned earlier about a demon and an angel fell in love, and they had a kid. As they're talking, Sheriff Root shows up and orders them to surrender. Jesse tells him he has like a weird voice, and he tells him to drop your weapons and let us go, which they do. After Jesse and his friends leave, the Santa Killer approaches Root, and we get a to be continued. And thus concludes the first issue of Preacher, which again, as I said before, and I'll say it again, it was a great series. If you're highly religious, it may be offensive to you. Basically, the story, like I said, in the beginning, they're talking about finding God. It's not a metaphysical or a spiritual, oh, I need to find God and get right my life. They're actually looking for God. Apparently, God got tired or something and just up and left heaven and left the world in a mess. So Jesse and his little band of friends are going to find God, kick him in the ass, and make him take responsibility for his work. So, anyways, now for my actual thoughts on this issue. First, we start off the cover, as we normally start. DC Vertigo. Vertigo was DC's line of comics that was more adult-oriented or wasn't quite for kids. They dealt with more adult themes, the supernatural. And this was one of their titles. It says Preacher along the top. We see a church with flames, looks like, in the background. And over the church, looking down, we see our star, Jesse Custer. He's got his hands clasped in front of him. We see his collar. And he looks like he's up to some bad shit, to me, anyways. He's got a look in his face like, I'm a badass, and I know it, and I'm going to kick some ass. But a great cover, though, again, by Glenn Fabry. It's a fantastic cover. I've got an issue of this somewhere signed by Garth Ennis. Me and a buddy met him at the San Diego Con many, many years ago. And I had him sign this for me. Anyways, that's the cover. Great cover. And then we move on to the actual story. We start at Five Aces Diner, where we see our group sitting around. Like I say, Steve Dillon did the art. He's got a very distinctive style. A lot of his characters' mouths have similar-looking mouths, kind of like a hayseed bucktooth kind of look to them a little bit. Some of the times, I don't care for his artwork, but in Preacher, I thought it worked very well. Again, very distinctive. So we got Jesse Custer in his preacher's outfit. He's got he says he's a preacher, and it looks more like a Pentecostal-type church, but he has a collar kind of like a priest has, so I'm not quite sure. We got Tulip, and as I mentioned, Cassidy. He's a Irish guy, earring one ear, sunglasses on, real scruffy looking. We go along, and Jesse and the other two are talking. And we find out that apparently they've got a past. They know each other from before. Tulip orders a chicken salad, holds the chicken. And she mentions she's now a vegetarian, and he's like, that's new. But as we go into the story, like I say, the first several pages of them sitting around talking, we see that they're getting caught up. Again, Jesse used to know Tulip, and he's meeting Cassidy. And they're probably just trying to figure out what's happened to them to this point. And that's the basis for the story, is they're flashing back, trying to get their heads on straight, but it's also telling us, as the reader, as to what happened in the past. And we get to our title page, finally, called The Time of the Preacher, where we see Custer walking down the street with a Bible in his hand, singing. And as he's walking down the street, he's singing something. So the verse we catch is, and the lesson's begun, I don't know the tune or anything, but which kind of, the lesson begins kind of apropos at this point, because he's going to go in here and teach all these rednecks a lesson. And then the next page we have Jesse Custer in the bar. Again, I mean, the artwork is, a lot of the faces look very similar. Steve Dillon has a distinctive style with his faces. Again, it's not a bad artwork. I enjoy the artwork in this. Steve Dillon's artwork, depends what he's doing. On your average superhero stuff, I don't like it as much, but on Preacher, I thought he did a wonderful job on it. I mean, well, like I say, his characters, or his art has a distinctive style, and they look kind of similar. His characters do look differently, so, I mean, it's great art. And like I said, so the next couple pages I talked about in the summary, him just talking to different people and telling the town's secrets to everybody. In fact, on this one page, copy I have is not numbered, so I'm not sure, but it's a couple pages in here. Looks like maybe around page 8 or so. He said there's also some kid named Michael. And this kid, I don't know what, it looks like he has no nose. He's got like a patch over it or something, or something bolted to it. I'm not quite sure. It's a little hard to tell, but again, it's very interesting artwork. Like I say, he's gone on some rednecks telling him that, about these two guys, Pat and Terry Morrow, who raped a girl, and the judge paid off, the daddy paid off the judge, and one of them, I don't know if it's Pat or Terry, takes a pool stick and hits Jesse in the back of the head and knocks him down. Then he starts kicking him, and then we see Jesse laying there, you know, unconscious. And again, we go back to a present day scene, if you will, where the three guys, Jesse and his two friends are sitting around talking. And oh, so with this last panel where he's talking about how the bartender stopped him from killing him, and he's like, well, he wasn't so bad for a beer water motherfucker. And this, where just the look on Jesse's face, I can't really describe it. It's a great scene, great panel, great artwork by Steve Dillon. And then we cut to the heaven scene where Genesis escapes that I mentioned earlier. And in heaven, it's like the prison where he was at. It's a white ball with five tubes coming out of it. One's got a big old hole in it where we see the three angels standing there talking. And I like the way they do the angels here. They're either bald-headed or they've got mostly bald with like a strip of hair down the middle. Kind of like a mohawk. And again, it's, they've got the same art style, but I enjoy this. And then one of the seraphim come, quoting one of his friends that's had his head torn off by the Genesis creature, if you will. And the angels that were watching after him are called Adelphi. And again, I like these, you know, next few pages. I mean, usually angels are drawn very beautiful and heavenly looking. These guys look ordinary for the most part, except for the wannabe mohawk down the middle of their head. And then the seraphim, I mean, it's big naked guy with big wings, and again, the one, not strand, but the one patch of hair straight down the middle of his head, really long, white eyes with black around it. For an angel, looks very menacing. And then it's a couple of pages we go over, you know, the seraphim tell them that they need to get Genesis back before it causes any trouble. And here's where one of our first mentions that God is actually buggered off. The seraphim's like, and just remember who's in charge around here. And one of the Adelphi's like, they were only left in charge. Which kind of lets us know that, you know, God isn't actually running the place at this point. And then, like I say, the next is just expositional, letting us know a little bit about Genesis, and that it's looking for a host body. And this is where they send one of their friends, Pylo, to go get the Saint of Killers at Boot Hill. Again, very nice art. I mean, and you can tell it's not a good thing for this, because, you know, it's like close-ups on them. Things are in shadow in the background. Then they're like, one of his, DeBlanc looks like he's the one that told him to do it. He's like, go to Boot Hill and wake the Saint of Killers. And this next panel is just the three angels standing there and with a white background. And the pilot, the one that's supposed to go get him, is like, me? Oh, it's, and like I say, it's a kind of a way the camera angle is looking down at him, like a medium away shot. And I mean, this one scene here lets you know that apparently the Saint of Killers, if you don't know him, this lets you know that he's apparently not a good guy, or just, he's not someone that they want to really deal with, but it's a very nice scene. And then we go back into Jesse and Tulip and Custer talking again. Not Custer, Cassidy. And we get Tulip's little backstory, where she walks up and she walks up his car, and one of the guys in the car asks her, you know, makes a little O with his finger, and he says, "Could you reckon you get your mouth around something this side? Because if you could, I'd like to marry you." And that's when she pulls a gun out and tries shooting. I think the guy that was coming, that was talking to her, but she misses him and hits the guy like two guys over and shoots him through the jaw, and bottom of his jaw almost falls off, it looks like. Again, that's one thing I enjoy about this series and about Dylan's artwork in here, is it's very, very graphic, but it can also be very humorous. Or maybe it's just my own warped, twisted sense of humor, but the scene where she shoots the guy, she's like, fuck, she misses the one she was aiming at, and the other guy that's just sitting there, his jaw's halfway blown off. It's very good, I like that. And after she takes off, we see the boss and the guy that got shot. The guy that got shot, his jaw's mostly hanging off, and he's got a look on his face like, what the fuck? And again, to know this is a flashback and not the current story, everything is in very muted colors, like blues, and just very one tone for the most part. Whereas the present day, you know, is in full four color and all that, so I like to do the flashbacks here. And we get Cassidy meeting Tulip as she steals his truck. And one of the guys, like I said in the synopsis, shoots at Cassie, and then we see it hit the side of his head. And he drives off. We see blood running down his face. And then we're back to present day, where again they're talking, and we find out that apparently Tulip used to hate guns. And this is where they get talking about the Saint of Killers. And I like how they describe them here. They're, because, again, Custer's like, well, you used to hate guns, Tulip. And Tulip's just staring at him, and Cassie's like, well, I know someone who doesn't. Custer's like, Oh, yeah. And Jesse's all, it's his voice that gets me. That crawling, grinding whisper. Spitting hell and ghosts and cobwebs in your ear. And that's where we're over on Boot Hill. Again, a very nice scene of a lone figure with a torch walking up the side of a cemetery. All these big fancy tombstones. Old school looking tombstones all over the place. And he enters this subterranean crypt, if you will, which is a pine box with a snake on top of it. And he says, awake, and as soon as the Saint of Killers sits up, he shoots the angel in the head. But again, being an angel, he doesn't die, or at least right away. He sits up, you know, he's got a hole in his eye where he got shot at, blood coming out of his eye. We see some smoke coming from the top of his head. And again, that's what I was talking about earlier with Cassidy's artwork. Dylan's artwork. I mean, it's very graphic and very brutal, but at the same time, it kind of makes me chuckle a lot. And when he's talking to the Sandy Killers, we see a side look, and we see the back of the Angel's head just blown clear off. So again, they're angels, so he didn't die, but he's a world of hurt, you can tell. I mean, maybe not hurt so much, but like I said, just the back half of his head just blown clear off, smoke's pouring out of it still. As the Angel tells the Sandy Killers about Genesis escaping, that they need to recapture him because he holds power He holds a power like unto that of God Almighty. It seeks the joint of the spirit of a mortal man. If it succeeds, the two together will know the secret ways of paradise, as no other mortal has done. Together, they could end us all. Again, very nice writing by Garth Ennis. To me, he's kind of like the Kevin Smith of the comic world, even though Kevin Smith's into comics also, but he's, you know, into dick and fart jokes, if you will. And people getting heads blown off, and he's like a mix of Quentin Tarantino with Kevin Smith to me, anyways. And then we get another scene looking at the Sandy Killers from the front and the Angel from behind, and again, his head's just, you know, the back half of his head's completely gone. We see his brains, and they're smoking as he's still telling, you know, the Sandy Killers he needs to go from this place and find, if it's joined with a man, kill him. Apparently he is dying, because as he's talking, he's like, you know, this isn't fair. I'm in Adelphi. I'm one of the host of angels. I never thought about sinning. I did everything I was told and never complained. And now, here in this black pit in the ground with my brain's blown out. What do you call that, eh? What do you call that? As he finally gives up the ghost, if you will. The Sandy Killer's like, good start. Yeah, I'm trying to imitate his voice, but you know, what the heck. And then the next page, we're back with them talking, and again, we flash back to the Sunday morning. Custer says he's got a full house, finally. Everyone wanted to see him, you know. He's like, well, either my prayers have been answered and the whole town has seen the light at once. And Cassidy's like, where they heard about you going mental the night before. And Jesse's like, Reverend Custer's losing his mind. Let's go see. Maybe he'll jerk off on the Bible or something. I figured that was a little more likely, but you always hope. And he's like, one look at their faces, I could tell the good Lord was using my prayers to wipe his ass. Again, this book is very irreverent. I mean, if you're a big Christian fan, you know, if you're a big Christian, you may not enjoy this book so much, because it does poke at God and religion as a whole. And then, you know, as he's getting his sermon, we see this white ball with, like, colors coming off of it blast in, and we see, looks like maybe a baby's face in the middle of the ball of color. As it hits Jesse, and he lights up. And I like the scene where, you know, after the Genesis creature enters Jesse's body, the next page we see, you know, the congregation is being reduced to bones. And then the church just explodes. It's a great, great little, it's a small, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's like a sixth of the page or so. But the church exploding is really cool, because we see it kind of expanding a little bit, and the roof's being blown off. I really like this scene. You know, Jesse's face on the last panel here is just a close-up of his face. His eyes are all white, hair standing up on end, his mouth's open, I'm assuming in pain. It's a very nice scene here of the Genesis merging with Jesse, if you will. And the next page, we have a splash page showing some angel-demon hybrid kind of behind Jesse. Jesse's really in front of it, showing that they're merging into one being. And this creature, like I say, we can't see a whole lot of the creature. We see his arms. He's got big wings behind him, his hair. Unlike the angels who have just that mohawk-type hair, this creature's got a blondish hair, and it comes up almost like a horns. And it looks like it has a breast, at least one breast. We can't really see. And then the lower portion of it is cloven hooves and very animalistic, demonic in nature, if you will. And then we cut back outside the church to see Tulip next to Cassie's truck, looking at like a mushroom cloud going up, going, "My God." And then we find out something a little bit more. Tulip's talking, she's like, Cassie had pulled over just before dawn. Then he got in the back, covered himself in a tarpaulin, and made me swear not to take it off of him. That's where we were when I saw the fire. Just like, hold on, him doing this didn't make you suspicious? And what they're getting at here is that, I don't know if I mentioned the recap or not, but Cassidy is a vampire. So we got a preacher, a wannabe assassin, and a vampire traveling around together. And again, some more of their writing here. I love Garth Ennis' writing. She tells him there's a mushroom cloud down the road. I'm going to read this next, these last couple panels here. He's like, I don't give a fuck, stop. And she's like, you didn't say not to drive the truck. All you said, and Cassie's like, I thought it was a bit bleeding obvious. I'm telling you, Tulip, right friggin' now, pull over and stop this truck or else. As we see him going to a sign that says, Welcome to Anvil, where Jesse was at. From the back of the truck, we see Cassie's like, I notice you haven't stopped. And again, we're at the church, and again, fantastic artwork here showing the church exploded. A few vehicles outside that are tipped over, upside down. Telephone pole leaning, or not telephone pole, but a telephone pole, electrical pole leaning sideways. And then Tulip goes exploring the ruins, and we see all these skulls and skeletons smoking in the blast zone. And that's where she finds Jesse. The only survivor, the only person that wasn't burnt to a cinder. And then we're back in present day again. And Jesse, you know, needs a smoke. So he said this machine's empty, so he's going to go find a store or something. And as he's walking away, we see a close up of his face and the word bubble saying, Well, Pilgrim? And then we see him walking away with, looks to be, John Wayne, a.k.a. the Duke. For you that don't know, the young kids out there may be listening, John Wayne was an old-school cowboy actor. I know my grandfather was a big fan of John Wayne movies. But anyways, he's like, couldn't help but notice you. Ain't mentioned me yet. Throughout this series, Jesse sees John Wayne's spirit or whatever you will. I forget the exact details. I just remember that he sees John Wayne and he has conversations with him. And then we're back to the flashback where we see Sheriff Fruit. Finally, we get to meet this warm, kind-hearted person. He's all, ask me, I reckon it was the niggers. And his deputy's like, how you reckon that, Sheriff Fruit? Kind of thing they do. What, burn 200 people to death? Right down to the ground? They do that? Marsh niggers, Kenny. Government and the FBI, they know shit they ain't telling us. Got an Air Force hangar with a spaceship in it, and a dead Martian nigger inside. Except they don't figure we're ready to know about it yet. As he spits a big ol' loogie out. Again, very racist, very asshole-ish sheriff here. But he's going to be a big part of this series. I would say I don't care for Sheriff Root, but I do. But I don't, you know, because he is a bit of an asshole, but he's a great character. Anyways, they talk a little bit more. Kenny apparently called in the FBI because that's procedures. And again, Roots just batshit crazy. He called the FBI and he told me, you know, this could be more than they could handle. And Roots like, could be. I'm going to ship me the keys to the Graceland tomorrow. But I kind of doubt that as well. Martian niggers, Kenny. You wait and see. Again, very good artwork here. Very, it's just good writing, good art. So far, this, you know, I'm enjoying everything I'm reading here. And then we go on and we see the three of them pulled over on the side of the road. This is still flashback territory. Jesse's waking up. And they're arguing whether they should take him to the hospital or what they should do with the unconscious Jesse. As I said, as he wakes up. And like this, again, it's more Garth Ennis' clever writing. He's like, oh, God, my fucking head. And Cassie's like, are you sure you're allowed to use language like that? Because, again, he's a preacher, but he's sitting there cussing like a sailor. And this is where Jesse tells us, you know, he's like, she asks what's wrong, and he's like, I don't know, it's I got this thing in my mind. Like, I've suddenly remembered all this shit, except it's not memories. It's been shoved in my head from outside. Christ, it's hurt. It's telling me. And Cassie interrupts. He's like, let me guess. It's God. And he says, women are all whores, and he wants you to punish them. And then Jesse tells the backstory of Genesis about a guy and a girl who fell in love and set the world on fire. And the kid they had something massive behind it all, something no one's ever supposed to know. Whatever it tells me, whatever it says, it sounds like the word of God. And in the background, on this big part of this page, we see one of the angels and a female demon having sex. The demon's not too cute, not too bad looking. She's kind of cute for a demon from the pits of hell. The cloven hooves doesn't do much for me, but you know. But we can definitely see that Genesis picture earlier when it was Virgin of Jesse. We see the angel part, we see the demons part, you know. So we can definitely see it's a merge of these two creatures. And as they're sitting there talking, trying to decide what to do, you know, there's a bright light on them as the police helicopter lands. And we get Sheriff Root pulling up in his thing, in his cars. I like this. Kenny gets out of the car and he's like, they don't look too colored to me, Sheriff Root. Root's like, Martian niggers don't have to be, and these are the only folks we found in 50 miles. And Tulip's like, oh Christ, not now. And Cassie's like, they're everywhere. This is like a fucking night out with O.J. Simpson. Because again, if you're too young to remember, you probably should be listening to this podcast, but back about the time this comic came out, I believe, right before it, Mr. O.J. Simpson, once a famous sports star, was accused of killing his wife and her friend, and he ran from the cops, and the cops chased him down, so that's kind of what Cass is referring to here. Again, I can't remember the exact date it happened or anything, but seeing how Cassie's making a reference to it, I'm assuming it was right around this time. And so the cops are like, hold it right there, boy. One more step and I'll blow your fucking head off. And then Jesse's like, drop the guns, all of you. And let us go. His eyes are all glowing red. And as he says that, we saw the guns, or all the cops dropping their guns. One drops his gun from the helicopter, hits the deputy on the head. And Tope's like the word of God. And at this point, they flee. And Root's like, I don't believe this. Pick up your frickin' fucking guns, you assholes. One of the deputies like, pick up yours. And after the gang takes off, the sheriff's like, you useless peckerwood cocksuckin'. And about this point, the Santa Killer walks up to him. The end. Next, just a few cops. So again, as I said, it's a great story. I love, again, this is when I first met Garth Ennis' work, and I really enjoyed it. having said that, a lot of his work gets kind of repetitive. He's got the same kind of storytelling all the time. But starting out, reading Preacher, I loved it. In fact, the entire series was great. I love Steve Dillon's artwork. Again, not all the time, but in the Preacher series, I thought the artwork was wonderful. I definitely recommend, especially like that kind of, you know, sick, twisted, demented humor, check out The Preacher. There's like 9-page paperbacks collecting the entire run. It's a great series. Don't take it too seriously. You're not going to enjoy it, but it's a great book. I really enjoy it. Anyways, that's what's in Ed's Long Box, Preacher, by Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon, from DC Comics / Vertigo. And that's it for what's in Head's Long Box today. Now, before we move on to our next segment, I call it advertising, but it's not really advertising. It's another promo. Here's another promo for a show that Brother Head enjoys. Secret governmental organization operating behind the scenes. Task Force X.
Task Force X is an off-the-books government strike team made up of convicts with no hope for release, serving as expendable agents for impossible missions. Succeed, and I'll shave time off your sentences.
If we don't,
you'll be dead. Any other stupid questions?
The Suicide Squad, ran by Amanda Waller.
I'm Amanda Waller. I'm here to indoctrinate you convicts into our special forces.
And there's Checkmate, ran by Harry Stein. This is the tales of DC Comics, Suicide Squad, and Checkmate. Mostly monthly from Head Speaks. Available on iTunes under Task Force X and under Headcast over at headspeaks.com. We can also be found on Facebook and Google Plus under Task Force X. Task Force X. Check it out, or you'll answer to the wall.
Nobody screws the wall!
And now, here is...
Yo, Joe!
We'll fight for freedom wherever there's trouble. G.I. Joe is there.
G.I. Joe, American hero.
And the masters of the universe.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Heroes in a half shell.
Turtle power.
Who you gonna call?
Whatever the challenge, they are ready. The Centurions
are the visionaries.
I am Dungeon Master, your guide in the realm of Dungeons and Dragons.
And now, geeking with Head.
Now I know. And knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe!
On today's Geeking with Head, I'm going to talk about comic book changes and old-timers versus newbies. I want to thank Scott Kowalski. He used to be a member of the Unite DC Comics Project for this. He got us... We were having a conversation about this on Facebook, and again, he was a bit of an asshat about it, not wanting to accept anything else, and he was the type, when he was posting, he would post very much, you know, these are changes, if you don't like it, fuck off. Anyways, so I don't want to thank him too much, but again, conversation I had with him on there made me decide to have this segment today, and this is borderline... bitches, moans, and gripes, and geeking with Head. But I'm going to talk about it here in Geek with Ed anyways. Before I say anything, I do want to start off by saying that, yes, new readers are needed for the comic book industry. I mean, as old-timers are going to start dying off, and you need new blood to pick up comics. But having said that, my problem is, let's go back a step, my problem that I'm talking about is the comic book industry, a lot of times they'll make change just for the sake of change or to be politically correct. Even though it annoys or upsets the older fan base, it's like they don't really care. They're just going for the trying to appease the newer audience. And yes, as I said, we do need the newer audience. But one thing they need to keep in mind is that, you know, longtime fans, we've supported the business for years. Even during the crap years, I mean, the loyal fans were there and buying the comics. And I know myself, back in the 90s and 2000s, I was spending a paycheck at a time almost on comics, it seemed like. I was buying almost every DC and Marvel comic out there. Even when some of the storylines got kind of crappy or stupid, I'd still support it and continue buying for the most part. Some got really bad, I would drop it, and then I would try again later, or something didn't hold my interest. Thor was one of those that I would pick up. It depends on the artist and the writer. I would read it for a while, and then I would get tired of it, and I would stop it, but that's beside the point. They've got a problem, like I say, with making changes just for change's sake, for political correctness, or what they call diversity. One thing that, you know, they like trying to bring new fans and what they call diversity. They keep changing the race and sex and what have you of a character. Like Alan Scott, the Golden Age Green Lantern over on Earth 2 in DC Comics. They've recently revamped and restarted the Earth 2 world, and now Alan Scott is gay. I'm not a big Alan Scott fan, so it doesn't bother me too much, but I can understand how fans, because again, the previous Alan Scott, he was married, he had a wife of a long time, and there's a lot of great stories there. But then we move on to one that kind of annoys me is Wally West. In the original DC Comics, he was Barry Allen's nephew by marriage. His wife, Iris West, was her nephew. He was a young kid, redhead, white kid, grew up, you know, in the heart of America, if you will. And he grew up and took on the mantle of the Flash, had his own family eventually. And then with the Flashpoint and the rebooting of the DCU with the new 52, he vanished. Still had Barry, still had the Impulse character. But the Wally West character just vanished. And they've recently reintroduced him, but he's now a black kid. And again, a lot of people say, well, that's racist. Why can't he be black? It's not so much racist, because to me, I don't like when they change the race either way. Because again, to me, it shows a lack of creativity. I mean, if they want to introduce a new speedster character that was a black kid, I wouldn't mind. But don't take Wally West and turn him black and say, we're being creative, we're being diverse. We now have a black character. No, all you're doing is taking a character that's, you know, already got an established history, an established fan base, you're painting him black and saying, this is diversity. It's not. It shows a lack of creativity. It shows pandering. It really annoys me. And again, it doesn't matter what way they change the race. One of my big beasts with this movie Spawn from back in the 90s was Terry Fitzgerald, Spawn's best friend. In the comics, he was a black guy. In the movies, he was played by D.B. Sweeney, a white guy. At the time, I loved D.B. Sweeney. I thought he was a great actor. But he's not Terry Fitzgerald. To me, race isn't something you just paint on somebody. It's a part of who they are. So again, with the Wally West, for instance, if they want to introduce a new guy, you know, Tyrone Fitzgerald or something, who is black, and he became a speedster. I wouldn't mind that. I think, yes, they do need to create new characters, they do need to update things for modern age, but taking a character and painting him a different color, or changing his sexual orientation, or making him a woman, keeping the same name, That's not being diverse. That's not being creative. That's just being lazy. My question is, because, again, the Scott guy I was referring to earlier, he was like, why can't they do that? Well, they can. It's their characters. They're right. They can do what they want. But to me, if you have a new fan, he's coming in to check out this Wally West character as a black speedster. To this new fan, what does it matter whether the new guy's name is Wally West or John Jameson or Paul Smith or anything else? The name's not going to matter to the new person. The only person named Wally West is going to appeal to, if you will, is the old school fan who's not going to like Wally West being turned to a black character just because. Again, not all old school fans are against it. Some are fine. Some don't care. But there is that percentage out there that says, you know, why mess with it? If, you know, a lot of fans were like, bring Wally back. We loved Wally. So DC said, well, here's Wally West. But it's not the same person. It's not the same character. Even if we, because again, yeah, we don't need Wally West, the wife and kids and the 20 years of baggage. I understand reboots are a necessity. A continuity, that's a topic for another time. So I understand that we need to reboot things and retell stories fresh for a new audience. But when the fans are saying we want Wally West, they want the redhead kid back. They want the white redhead kid from middle America. They want him back. They don't want some other person with the same name. So again, to me, taking Wally West, making him a black character, changing him around to make him more modern, isn't appeasing the Wally West fans. I mean, if you took a new character, name George Smitherton, for instance, I'm just throwing out names, a black kid, became a speedster, maybe if you want to have him related, make him another nephew of Iris if you want. But if you give him a different name and the new fans will still like him because he's the same character he had before, except for a different name, an original name, and the old school fans won't feel like you're pissing on him or shitting on him by saying, well, here's Wally West you wanted, when it's a completely fucking different character. And again, I get a little heated about this because, I enjoy comics. Comics are my life. And it just annoys me when the comic companies piss all over things just for what they call diversity. Well, it's not even... yes, it is diversity, but it's not. I mean, for instance, they claim they want diversity, yet most of their characters had to fit in this model of all their characters being young, good-looking, CW characters, as I call them. One that really annoys me, and if you may have heard this if you listen to my Task Force X podcast, available on the Head Speaks Network. Amanda Waller, back in the 80s when John Ostrander wrote her, she was a short, overweight woman, very powerful. I mean, she would go toe-to-toe with Batman and, make Batman back down. So, she was a very powerful woman. And, very heavy set, very, she wasn't what you'd call a supermodel. She got where she was at just by, the size of her own balls, being bigger than everyone else. I mean, she was a powerful woman. And now DC's rebooted her. She's a young, thin, supermodel looking. I see bits of Amanda in there that I used to know, the determination and all that, but part of me, the way they drew her to make her look supermodel thin and, wearing the short skirts and... Did she get where she's at by the power she wields or about, being brazen enough to, and ballsy enough to take charge? Or is she sleeping way to the top? I mean, again, you want diversity, but, Amanda Waller, a heavyset character, is now another super thin, beautiful woman. Also, Deadshot, a.k.a. Floyd Lawton, used to be an older guy, kind of a porn mustache going on. A real seasoned, real weathered guy. Again, in the new 52, when they rebooted him, he was younger. They got rid of his mustache. He looked a lot younger, better looking guy. Here in the new Suicide Squad, they've given him his mustache back, so that's an improvement. But again, they're not going for diversity. They're going for the same. Everyone needs to look the same cookie cutter, beautiful CW persona. And I just, to me, that annoys me. You claim you want diversity. That's why you change his character black, change his character gay. But then on the flip it around, and if they're not young and good looking, you're going to make them look that way. Where's the diversity there? I don't know. That's one of my big pet peeves. And again, like I said at the beginning of this segment, that yes, we do need new readers. But if the changes you're making, if they bring in new readers, but you're pushing your old readers away, is it worth it? I mean, yes, if the new readers that are coming in outnumber the readers that are leaving, yes, it's a positive. But with these new fans that are coming in only temporary for the short term, and you push away your old fans, is it still worth it? I mean, you got someone like me that's been reading comics. A newbie to as far as fandom goes. I mean, I only started buying comics in the late 80s. Some guys have been reading them since the 60s and 70s. You push them away that's been spending their money for years, they're going to keep spending their money until they die, for 10 new people that's only going to pick up the book for the next couple of months, and they're going to drop it because of how expensive comics are. And, you know, they can spend a little bit more money and buy a video game. And honestly, that's, you know, what the younger kids nowadays are into. Is it really worth it to get these fans for a couple months if you're losing your old-time readers? And again, it's an example I posted to that Scott Yahoo, who kind of ignored it and was acting stupid. I'm like, okay, so say you've got 20 comic book fans, or potential comic book fans. 10 of them are currently reading the book. They're old-school, long-term fans. And then you reboot, you change the characters around, you make Wally West a black kid now, and you gain 5 new readers. But at the same point, you lose, say, 5 of your long-term fans. So you haven't really gained any. You're still at 10. You're still at 10 readers. Now, if you same scenario, instead of this new black kid named Wally West, his name was Phil Wilson. You're not going to annoy those 5 comic book fans that drop. So you're going to keep them. You're going to get the 5 new readers because they don't care whether it's Phil Wilson or Wally West or Chuck McGee or whatever. So at that point, you're up 5 fans. So you've got 15 readers instead of just the 10. To me, that seems to be the best marketing strategy, the best moneymaker right there. Because even if 2 or 3 of these new fans drop off, you haven't annihilated your old fan base. And again, you know, that Scott idiot was like, oh, I would take just the lesser fans just because I can make a change just because I can. And that's not a way to run a company. I don't know what the guy does for a living, but apparently he's not a big business owner. Otherwise, he's not doing very good. But anyways, that's my small little rant on comic book changes and old-timers versus newbies and all that. What do you guys think? Am I crazy? Do you guys think I'm right? Is the comic companies, you know, shooting themselves in the foot by making these diversity changes just for the hell of it? Let me know what you think. You can either let me know on Facebook or on my headspeaks.com and go to Headspeaks and leave a comment on the blog. Send me an email at head@headspeaks.com. But give me your opinion. I'm interested in hearing it. Anyways, I think that's going to be it today for Geekin' with Head.
Hello, I'm Albie.
And I'm Heather.
And we do the Quantum Leap Podcast. It can be found at quantumleappodcast.com and also on iTunes.
We are starting at the beginning of Quantum Leap and going through all the episodes. This is my first time watching, and Albie has seen them during their original run.
In each podcast, we talk about the overall thoughts of each episode. We do an episode recap if you haven't seen them in a while, just to refresh your memory. And then we do a detailed plot discussion.
And we also have some great interviews.
Scott Bakula, I remember being very, very generous of spirit and very, very kind to his fellow actors. It was my first kiss ever. So I am getting to kiss Scott Bakula on screen.
And everybody involved with it was just terrific. And I'm always amazed that people come up to me and remember that episode and can quote things from it that I can't even quote.
So if you're a leaper, it'd be great if you came and joined us. And if you've never heard of Quantum Leap, it's maybe a good time to start watching it because you have a podcast to go along with it.
So please give our podcast a listen and hopefully you like us and stick around.
Go to quantumleappodcast.com to listen to new episodes.
And now for Head's final thoughts. Well, hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Again, as always, if you want to record a message, you can send it to me at head@headspeaks.com. Record a message in MP3 format, send it to me, and I will play it on the air. If you're interested in commenting, please either jump on my Facebook or Google+ at headspeaks. Go to my website, headspeaks.com, click on headcasts, and from there you can click on the headspeaks portion. Again, you can listen, as I said before, you can now listen to my episodes on my website via the Stitcher Player. But again, you can go there, you can leave a message on the blog. As I said before, you can send just me a regular email at head@headspeaks.com. Let me know what you guys think about anything I've talked about. If you've watched The Crow, let me know your opinions on it. If you've read Preacher, let me know what you think. Do you like it? Is it a good book? Am I off the mark? And as far as my topic about comic book changes and newbies versus old readers, what do you think about that? Let me know. And for the final song for the day, I am going to play a song called Children's Story. It's by Slick Rick. It's off of his album called The Great Adventures of Slick Rick. Not that it really pertains to anything I've talked about today. It's just I enjoy that song. Again, I'm an old school rap fan, so... After the credits, stay tuned and listen for Children's Story by Slick Rick. But that's it for today, kids. I am Brother Head, and you have heard Head Speaks. Bye.
What a blast, kid. We sure had good fun while it lasted. Hung out with friends and hit the skins. Next week we're gonna do it again.
Thank you for listening to another great episode of Head Speaks. Be sure to look for me on the web. I can be found rambling on my Task Force X headcast, where I cover all the appearances of the Ostringer Suicide Squad and Kupperberg's Checkmate comic books from the late 80s, early 90s. Both Head Speaks and Task Force X can be found on iTunes and over there on Stitcher Radio. My home on the inner tubes is my official website, headspeaks.com. headspeaks.com. Links to my blog, which contain follow-up information to this and every headcast, can be found there. I'm also over on Facebook at Head Speaks, the community, not the page. That's somebody else. On Google+, look for Head Speaks. Please feel free to email your bitches, moans, and gripes to headspeaks@headspeaks.com. Also, feel free to email any compliments you have also. And if you want to be heard on Head Speaks, you can go ahead and record a message and you can send it to me at head@headspeaks.com and I'll play it on the air. Be sure to join us here next time for another fun-filled headcast from your friendly neighborhood Brother Head. And hey, be sure to tell a friend. Until next time, I'll see you in the funny pages.
You kids get to bed, I get the storybook. Y'all tucked in? Here we go. Once upon a time, not long ago, when people wore pajamas and lived life slow, where laws were stern and justice stood, and people were behaving like they ought to good, there lived a little boy who was misled by another little boy, and this is what he said. Me and you tonight, we're gonna make some cash, robbing old folks and making the dash. They did the job, money came with ease, but one couldn't stop, it's like he had a disease. He robbed another stick and another, and a sister and a brother. Tried to rob a man who was a DT undercover. The cop grabbed his arm, he started acting erratic. He said, "Keep still, boy, no need for static." Punched him in his belly and he gave him a slap. But little did he know, the little boy was strapped. The kid pulled out a gun, he said, "Why'd you hit me?" The barrel was set straight for the cop's kidney. The cop got scared, the kiddie starts to figure, "I'll do years if I pull this trigger." So he cold dashed and ran around a block. Cop radios into another lady cop. He ran by a tree, there he saw the sister. Shot for the head, he shot back, but he missed her. Looked around good and from expectations, he decided he'd hit for the subway stations. But what? She was coming and he made a left. He was running top speed till he was out of breath. Knocked an old man down and swore he killed him. Then he made his move to an abandoned building. Ran up the stairs up to the top floor. Opened up a door there, guess who he saw?
Who?
Dave the dope fiend shooting dope. Who don't know the meaning of water nor soap, he said.
"I need bullets, hurry up, run."
The dope fiend brought back a spanking shotgun. He went outside, but there was cops all over. Then he dipped into a car, a stolen Nova. Raced up the block doing 83. Crashed into a tree near university. Escaped alive, though the car was battered. Rat-a-tat-tatted and all the cops scattered. Ran out of bullets and he still had static. Grabbed the pregnant lady and pulled out the automatic. Pointed at her head, he said the gun was full of lead. He told the cops, "Back off, for honey here's dead." Deep in his heart, he knew he was wrong. So he let the lady go and he starts to run on. Siren sounded, he seemed astounded. And before long, the little boy got surrounded. He dropped his gun, so went the glory. And this is the way I have to end this story. He was only
17.
What? In a madman's dream. The cop shot the kid, I still hear him scream. This ain't funny, so don't you dare laugh. Just another case about the wrong path. Straight and narrow or your soul gets cast. Good night.
Knock him out the box, Rick. Knock him out, Rick.
Oh, boy. That Uncle Rick is really weird.
Knock him out, Rick.
Knock, 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 knock,